The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
It's great to see you here today at City Bible Forum this lunch hour. And if this is your first time joining us today, then an especially warm welcome to you. My name is Caroline Spencer and I work for City Bible Forum. And our topic today is, how can you take the Bible seriously when it's full of myths and legends? Our speaker is Al Stewart. And inside your programs, you'll notice there's a slip of white paper. And that's actually for you to write down any questions that you have that arise as you listen to Al speak. We'll collect those questions after Al's talk and then Al will have a go at answering them. In your programs, you'll also see that there's an excerpt from the Bible on the left-hand page. And I'm going to read the first one there, which is from Luke. It's from Luke's Gospel, and that Luke's Gospel is one of the four biographies of Jesus' life that's in the Bible. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught.
In around April of this year, one of our federal politicians, you may be able to guess which one of our federal politicians suggested that it would be a good idea if everyone in our schools engaged with particular texts or books that had a huge influence on our society. And he included the Bible. Now that made for a bit of a furore and people were cranky about the idea of people being taught the Bible. But in response to that, there's a young man called Scott Monk, who's a well-known author of young adults books, wrote an article in Quadrant. And I'd just like to read you one or two paragraphs of what Scott Monk says about studying the Bible. And I've also included on your program the online address where you can find this article. It's actually very good, but it's 4 or 5 pages, too long to read now. This is what he says. Why shouldn't elements of the Bible be taught in public schools? It has had an unparalleled impact on Western culture, history, music, the arts, politics, morality, law and literature. Are we embarrassed about our country's foundations? Or worse, have we become intellectual cowards? The irony cannot be overlooked. Bible societies worldwide are unable to keep up with demand in countries like India and China. But in so-called Christian countries, many Australians have more knowledge of the television guide. Now, he's certainly right that the Bible's had a massive influence on Western culture, on Australia. At a trivial level, there's all sorts of things that we say in general, kind of just general conversation, like you call someone a Judas, or you call someone a good Samaritan, or you say, am I my brother's keeper, or like a lamb to the slaughter. In fact, I found one website that listed 50 sayings like that that have come from the Bible. I'm sure there's more than 50 if we sat down and thought about it. But at a deeper level, the Bible has influenced the worldview that our culture has. Our worldview in terms of the value of human life, human rights, our legal system, the way our government operates, our understanding of power and corruption and why that shouldn't happen. In fact, Rodney Stark, the American academic who I mentioned last week about in relation to the Crusades, Stark's got a couple of books that argue very strongly that law and lawmakers being under the law themselves, democracy, the creation of wealth, the rise of capitalism and the rise of science all flow out of a worldview that comes from the Bible and Christian theology. He makes the case very strongly. Now, all of those things are good. However, we need to acknowledge the Bible is a very big book, 1,000 or more pages, and there's things in the Bible that are very strange to modern ears. There's miracles. There's the 10 plagues that God brings on Egypt. There's God speaking from the mountain. There's Noah and there's the flood and Jonah and the whale and so on. all sorts of things. And there are legitimate questions too. Like how much of some parts of these Old Testament stories, what's a parable, what's a metaphor, what really happened, that can be hard to work out. Is there archaeological evidence? And the answer is, well, there's archaeological evidence for some things, but not for others. So a key point in the Old Testament is God brings the nation of Israel to Mount Sinai and gives them the Ten Commandments. Well, I've been to Sinai and there isn't really any archaeological evidence to say that that happened. But then when I thought about it, it was kind of a big camping trip 3,000 years ago. You wouldn't expect there to be archaeological evidence. But how can we know? How can you begin to get a handle on the Bible and what's kind of true, what's history? Is it full of myths and legends? Here's what I want to suggest, and that is the place to start is with the person of Jesus. So to start with Jesus for a number of reasons. Firstly, Jesus is the beating heart of the Bible. Of the 1,000 or more pages, the first about 700, the Old Testament, all of that looks forward to his arrival. And the next 300 or so, the New Testament, that is all about looking back to what he did and forward to the implications of that. Jesus is the beating heart of the Bible. And as well as that, when Jesus speaks, he actually kind of oozes out Old Testament scripture. He quotes it with authority and familiarity. It's as if he wrote it. And so if you can focus on Jesus and work out, are the accounts of Jesus historically accurate rather than being myths or legends? If Jesus truly is who he says he is, if he's historically verifiable, then that gives you a lens to read the rest of the Bible. And it helps you understand how to take that and what authority, actually Jesus gives authority to the Old Testament in the way that he speaks. And the other reason to do it is the Gospels are manageable. The Gospels are 20 or 30 pages. They're not 1,000 pages. It's possible to get your head around that reasonably quickly. So let's have a look at what I want to do today is have a look to you about the historicity of Jesus. Let me start with a quote about a biography. The dates of his life are still controversial, but no biography was written for several hundred years after the life had ended, and the available sources for such information are such a mixture of history and legend as to prove the despair of all historians. As many as four different versions are sometimes given of one event, and as others appear in widely different sequences, only by piecing together a score of passages from various parts of the existing canon does a consistent story appear. As the centuries rolled by, each version of the life acquired an increasing garland of fabulous adventure, miracle, and heavenly assistance. Now, I agree with that completely. It's absolutely true. Written by a man called Christmas Humphreys, 1951, except it's actually a book about Buddhism. Now, he's written that. I'm not having a go at the Buddha. This is this Buddhist man writing about the life of Buddha. And what he's saying is they don't know the details of his kind of historical life, or they're very sketchy. It's very hard to put together an accurate biography. And what he's saying is it doesn't matter. Why? Because Buddha, the enlightened one, teaches how to live and the path to follow to find enlightenment. The details of his own life don't really matter that much. Christianity is fundamentally different. What Christianity is about is the actual events in history that objectively happened. The birth, life, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus. And what Christianity is about is not kind of following the path so much to enlightenment. No, it's actually about putting your trust in what Jesus has done and who he is. And so if we don't know those facts and those public events, Christianity just kind of disappears into the sand. And that's what the New Testament writers are telling us. What I thought I'd do today is actually take us through mainly what one of the New Testament writers says that he's doing. So on your program, there's the beginning of Luke's Gospel. And what do we know about Luke? Well, we know from the rest of the New Testament that Luke was a doctor, that Luke was a Gentile, he wasn't Jewish, and that Luke travelled with the Apostle Paul and saw what Paul did firsthand. And so I'd just like to take you through his introduction and make three points as we go from those verses. Firstly, to look at events fulfilled, and then secondly, eyewitnesses, and thirdly, the idea of impartiality. events fulfilled, eyewitnesses, impartiality. Let's have a look at Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Those little words, fulfilled among us, you actually miss that as you just read past. What's he saying? The Jesus events that happened in those 30 or so years didn't just happen kind of at random. They didn't just pop up. They're part of a long series of events and writings and promises that have happened through the Old Testament. So the first five books of Moses, Genesis and following, are written around about 1300 BC. And they reach back much further as well as they recount the stories. But each of those books of the Old Testament look forward or are fulfilled in Jesus. Promise after promise about God sending his Messiah, his great King, who will save his people and renew creation one day. So these events are a fulfillment. And the miracles that happen in the New Testament, and yes, I believe in miracles, the New Testament says Jesus did them. The miracles are not just party tricks. It's not, hey, watch me pull a rabbit out of the hat. It's not that. It's Jesus acting to fulfill the promises in the Old Testament. When God's King comes, the blind will see and the deaf will hear and the lame will walk. And it's also him showing what it will be like when he does renew the creation and there'll be no more mourning or crying or pain. So they fit into a context. They're not just random. Okay, fulfilled. Now, see what he says in the next verse about eyewitnesses. Second point. Many have right that these things are fulfilled among us. Verse 2. Just as they were handed down to us by those who, from the first, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Do you notice Luke is not saying that he was an eyewitness? Would have been easy for him to say that, wouldn't it? And kind of boost his credibility. But no, he's saying he wasn't an eyewitness, but there were others who were, and this has been handed down to Luke and to others. All right. So, how do we know, though, about the eyewitnesses? Well, Luke has been a historian, a journalist, an investigative reporter. He's been and spoken to people and then written down his account. What do we know about the eyewitnesses? They're eyewitnesses to public events. Public events. You might think, yeah, what's that big deal? And very important. As far as I'm aware, every other major religion is based on the idea of spiritual revelations to or enlightenment by a religious leader, so that God speaks to the prophet Muhammad, is his claim. Or the Buddha, the enlightened one, comes to enlightenment. Now, those things may or may not have happened, but because they're a private thing, it's impossible to falsify them. You cannot say that, oh, that vision, that experience did not happen. Christianity is different to that in that it's based on these public events. So that if you can show the birth, life, death, resurrection of Jesus didn't happen, Christianity falls over. That's why the eyewitness thing really matters. Now, how do we know about the eyewitnesses? Well, the evidence for the eyewitnesses is cumulative rather than just one big thing. For example, the quickest way to do it would be to Google rather than get on an aeroplane. But if you Google the John Rylands Library at Manchester University, they have there a tiny little bit of papyri about the size of the palm of your hand. I'll read it for you. This small fragment of John's Gospel, measuring less than 9 centimetres high, is one of the collection of Greek papyri at the John Rylands Library, Manchester. On one side it contains parts of verses 31 to 33, on the other side parts of verses 37 to 38 of the 18th chapter of John's Gospel. It was originally discovered in Egypt. The importance of this fragment is quite out of proportion to its size, since it may, with some confidence, be dated in the first half of the 2nd century AD, so between 100 and 150 AD, and thus ranks as the earliest known fragment of the New Testament in any language. It provides us with invaluable evidence of the spread of Christianity in areas distant from the land of its origin. It is particularly interesting to know that among the books read by the early Christians in Upper Egypt was St. John's Gospel, commonly regarded as one of the latest of the books in the New Testament. So by the year... Now, some people actually come and nail it down to 130, They're a little more, like they're saying 100 to 150 on the website. But that means within just a few years of when John would have died, that gospel has been translated and passed down and is down in Alexandria in Egypt. It was written, so that's the earliest physical piece we have of the New Testament. And that's, John is probably the last of the gospels written. There's other ways of trying to put it together in terms of internal evidence. So, for example, Luke writes his account of Jesus, and then his second volume, the book of Acts, A-C-T-S, as in act of a play, it covers about the next 30 years, the beginnings of the early church and what the apostles did, the Acts of the Apostles. As Luke writes, the kind of the climax of the story, the last five, six, seven chapters, are all about the Apostle Paul as a prisoner on his way to Rome to appear before the emperor to be tried. And it's a ripping yarn with shipwrecks and storms and all sorts of things. And they get to Rome, and then the story stops with Paul under house arrest. And you can't help but think, well, what happened? Well, we know from other sources the Apostle Paul was executed under Nero in about the mid-60s. But Luke gets to that point and then stops. Why? The most obvious answer is that's when he stopped writing. He may have just run out of scroll. I don't know, but we're not told why. And the other surprising thing is Luke doesn't mention the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70, which is a cataclysmic event for the Jewish people of that time and the, you know, and so on, in the Middle East. So Luke doesn't mention, Luke's gospel is finished by the mid-60s. And as Luke comes to write, he has already taken or used some of Mark's material. It's like Mark was finished by then and Luke has copied parts of Mark, is the way they used to do in the ancient world. They'd copy from one another as well. The Apostle Paul's earliest letters are dated from about 49 to 51 AD, 17 or 18 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So close in time. Not only that, one more piece of thing, if you can hold it in your head. From the beginning of the second century, kind of the 100s, you've got second century Christian writers, Ignatius, Polycarp, Clement of Alexandria and so on, and they're beginning to quote the New Testament. In fact, you can find quotes for 25 out of 27 of the New Testament books starting in the early hundreds, meaning it was all written within the lifetime of the followers of Jesus and began to circulate and so on. Okay, good. Well, we've got what the, we know what the eyewitness said. Were they telling the truth? Well, one thing you can do is you can cross-reference that with what the non-Christian historians say. You know, they didn't have any particular reason to promote Christianity. Is there any non-Christian evidence for Jesus? In Josephus, very famous Jewish historian of the time, wrote a big long history of Israel and particularly the wars with Rome. Josephus mentions many of the characters in the New Testament. Mentions Jesus briefly, mentions James, the brother of Jesus, mentions John the Baptist, the Herod family, Pontius Pilate, the high priests, etc. Interestingly, he doesn't say much about Jesus as he writes. You think, well, you know, Jesus changed the world. Why didn't he mention him? Ah, it's all about timing. If you got back copies of Time magazine or Fortune magazine in the 70s, my guess is you'd have to look very hard to find anything about Bill Gates. You just wouldn't. Now, does that mean Bill Gates wasn't beavering away in Seattle working out how to change the world? No, no, he was there. He just wasn't kind of above the radar in a big way. Now, he owns the radar, all right? But it's all in the timing. Now, the Jesus movement began very small. By the early 300s, it was huge and eventually becomes the official religion. It's just time. But Jesus is mentioned by non-Christian historians. Josephus, I'll show you the words of Tacitus. Tacitus wrote a big long history of the Roman Empire, mentions at some length about Nero and the fire of Rome in the mid-60s. Oh, by the way, Tacitus wrote about 100. That's about when he wrote. Let me read to you a quote from him. Nero, there was a rumour spreading that Nero, first century property developer kind of thing, had started the great fire. Here's the quote. For a rumour had spread that while the city was burning, Nero had gone to his private stage and, comparing modern calamities with ancient, had sung of the destruction of Troy. Now there's a myth, isn't it? Nero fiddled while Rome burned. It's a myth. He sang. For people believed that Nero was ambitious to found a new city to be called after himself. To suppress this rumour, Nero fabricated scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were popularly called. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. First, Nero had self-acknowledged Christians arrested and then executed, tortured. Do you see that? See what's interesting with that quote? In the mid-60s, just 30 years after Jesus is crucified, there are enough Christians in Rome for them to be disliked and blamed for the fire. Christianity didn't slowly spread out across the empire. It exploded across the empire. As well as that, you've got the Jewish writings of the time that talk about Jesus. They're not complimentary, but they talk about him, other Roman references and so on. In fact, I'll say a little more about this book soon, but John Dixon, in his book The Christ Files, lists what you can know about Jesus from non-Christian sources. So from the Greco-Roman world and the Jewish writings, here's some things. I can give them to you very quickly. You know, the name of Jesus, the time and place of his public ministry, the name of his mother, the ambiguous nature of his birth, the name of one of his brothers, his fame as a teacher, the claims that he was a miracle worker, that he was called the Christ, his kingly status in the eyes of some, the manner of his execution, the coincidence of an eclipse at the time of his crucifixion, and the reports of his resurrection. All from outside the New Testament. One other question that might be worth asking is, all right, well, the eyewitnesses, yes, and it gels, you know, with what we know from the non-Christian historians, but we don't have the originals. What about, how do we know what they wrote? What we do have is original copies that are much closer to the time of writing than other ancient works. And once again, massive amount of information, and I've way oversimplified, but if I could show you, for example, the way they measure this is, how long is the gap between when the actual document was written and the earliest physical copy that we have? For the writings of Caesar and the writings of Tacitus, the gap is around about 1,000 years. For the New Testament, depending on how you're counting it, between 30 and 90, less than 100 years. And the number of manuscripts, 10, 20 for the other ancient works. Now, when you say 24,000, I think the source that I'm quoting was counting pieces and so on of manuscripts. The earliest complete hold-in-your-hand version of the New Testament is around about 300, around about that. You might think, well, wait a minute, how do you know about the originals? Let me see if I can sum up textual criticism in 30 seconds. Here we go. If I handwrite a letter and then hand it to Carolyn, there's only one copy. What if she said, well, actually, this sounds pretty good, and then she gives it to two or three of her friends, and they make copies of it, and then some others make copies of it, and then they take them interstate in each of the capital cities. And over time, there are copies very carefully made of that letter. So we end up with hundreds of copies, but over time, they've developed in the different capital cities. In 100 years, even if we don't have the original, we can sit down with those copies that have been in different places and line up 10 different copies, and any slight copying errors just kind of fall out and are obvious. Now, that's what's been done with the New Testament multiplied by 100 times. So you can pick up a Greek New Testament and actually see where there's any differentiation between manuscripts, and they can weigh up what's the variation. But there's no significant doctrine or teaching that hangs on any of the copying variations anyway. Written in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, lining up with non-Christian histories, and I think there's good evidence that we do actually have what they wrote. But the last point I wanted to talk about was impartiality. See verse 3, are the writers impartial? Short answer is no, they're not. They're like me, they've got an agenda, they're trying to convince you. Look at what Luke says. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write you an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now, we don't know who Theophilus was. It may have been the patron who supported Luke while he did his research. He also talks about Theophilus in his second volume as well. You notice Theophilus already knew the stories. And that is, at first, the stories were passed on verbally. So the apostles, as they taught, they recounted what had happened. You think, oh, 30 years is a long time. No, it's not. I'm going to be a granddad in December. I can remember 30 years, no trouble at all. I got married 30 years ago. I remember that. That's not a difficulty. And also, John Dixon has an excellent chapter in here about cultures that work on memory and orally learning things in the Middle East and in Asia. In fact, if you put your mind to it, you really can learn things brilliantly. One of my daughters applied her mind when she's a little younger and learned a 90-minute script, word for word. You could say to her, start here, and she could give you every character in the script, and it could be just trotted out, and she could have done it for the full 90 minutes. Unfortunately, it was an Adam Sandler movie, so it wasn't a great use of mental power, but I just made me think, you can learn things off by heart. Maybe better things than that. Why is Luke writing to Theophilus? Answer, to convince him, or to keep him convinced so that he can know the certainty of what he's been told. His aim is to convince us. You think, well, wouldn't it be better to have, like, impartial writers? Very hard to be impartial about the New Testament, really. Because as you come to it, what is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying he created you. He gives you life. And you owe him that life and owe him love and service and respect as the one who gives you life. And you haven't done that properly. You've walked away from him. If you come back, he'll forgive you and give you life now and the promise of life in eternity. If you ignore him and walk away, you'll be sent away from him and away from life for eternity. I just don't know how anyone can be impartial about that. If that is true, we've got to take it seriously. If it's not true, we can walk away and ignore it. It's like the judge who, if she was going to try a case and she decided one way, she'd get her share portfolio go up $10 million. If she decided another way, the share portfolio would go down $10 million. She'd have to disqualify herself. She couldn't be impartial. I just think the idea of impartiality as you come to the New Testament, that's a myth. And John is trying to do the same thing. John's trying to convince us because it's so important. You see, I put verse of John's Gospel on the left-hand side of the program as well. John tells us in chapter 20, verse 30, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. To believe or trust is the same word in the original. He's saying, the events are written down, I'm writing them down so you can trust Jesus and find life, eternal life. I'm going to invite you actually to, or ask you, if you haven't already, to consider reading two different documents. The first one, you may be interested to read John Dixon's book, The Christ Files. It's available in book, or if you're not, don't really read much, there's a DVD of it as well with John walking around the Middle East and so on. It's only 98 pages, it's large print, and it's brilliantly simple. Not simplistic, but brilliantly simple about how historians know what they know about Jesus. Good read. If you're interested, Carolyn might tell us how you can get a copy of that. We could arrange that for you. The second thing, what Jesus claims about his words is that these aren't just historical documents. These aren't just interesting words. These are the words of God. And what Jesus says is, if you actually come to his words, to the words of the New Testament, the words of the Bible, but particularly let's talk about his words, if you come to his words with an open heart, if you're seeking the truth, you will know, God will reveal to you that it's true. Have a look at across on the left-hand page is John chapter 7, verse 17, where Jesus says, if anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. So if you haven't read a gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke or John, if you haven't read that, I would invite you to read it and actually pray and ask that God would open your heart to show you, is this true? And see what happens. Carolyn.
Thank you, Al. Please be writing your questions on the white slips of paper, and our ushers are very kindly going to go round and see if there are any questions and collect them. Now, any questions? No collected questions, Al?
Anyone? Yep. Is the New Testament unique in that it's claiming history and so on? I'm not an expert. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on other religious texts. As far as I understand, the New Testament is the only one that's anchored in history in that same way, with eyewitnesses, yes. Now, the Buddhist writings offer the way of enlightenment and so on. I have read, what I read of the Quran seems to be, it offers wisdom and so on about God. But the New Testament, in anchoring it in time and place and public events, is unique, as far as I am aware.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.